Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so Nicolas Roussalis is associate professor in practical philosophy at Erasmus University Rotterdam and associate professor in political philosophy at the University of Athens. He's going to talk about capitalist domination under democratic capitalism and has worked extensively on Marx domination. Kant, he's the author of Exploitation as Domination with Oxford University Press and also the editor, or is no, it's a book on Kant on citizenship and poverty with Cambridge University Press. So I think he's a fellow Kantian Marxist, no?
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Leah, for inviting me. Thanks. Thank you all for coming. I was planning to talk about labor before citizenship, thereby resolving all the discussions and problems we've had today, thinking about the relationship between labor, justice, freedom, and what makes labor special, but I decided against it because I thought doing something like this would talk more directly to our question, the dialogue between liberalism and liberal egalitarianism and socialism. But we can talk about the more positive picture I want to paint here about the nature of labor and its connection with citizenship and justice more generally in the Q&A. But what I'll try to do now is focus a bit more narrowly on what Jan called the internal domination-based critique of liberalism and think specifically and perhaps slightly more narrowly about democratic capitalism and how to think of a critique of democratic capitalism from the inside, if you like. And so I'm going to talk about, like Jan, three issues. You know, in philosophy, problems come in threes. Two or too few, four or too many, you know. So always three. So I'm going to talk about these three issues, which have to do with oft-quoted and often rehearsed justifications of capitalist institutions and attempts to ameliorate arguments from democratic capitalism, thereby abstracting a core, what I take to be the core of the domination-based critique of capitalism. So many philosophers and economists believe that capitalism can, under certain conditions, be made hospitable to equal freedom. And for some of them, these conditions are about the existence of good, valuable exit options, such as a generous welfare state, for example, or an unconditional basic income. Others think that the existence of competitive markets and the absence of monopolies is an appropriate market regulation are all ways to justify and extend the good-making features of capitalism. And for yet others, these conditions are about equal opportunity for political influence of free and equal citizens. So each of these views, and these views jointly, suggest that capitalism could be made hospitable to freedom were it not for some bug that is not intrinsic to capitalism. Dearth of options, absence of competition, absence of equal opportunity for political influence. At the very least, these conditions suffice individually or jointly to significantly attenuate any putative relationship of capitalist domination. All of these beliefs are false. They are false because capitalism, in the sense of the private monetized ownership of scarce productive assets, is an intrinsically unfree mode of production. And it's on freedom and the focus of freedom that I want to emphasize here. So what I want to try to argue briefly and try to convince you is that the presence of good exit options under capitalism is insufficient for non-domination, that the existence of perfectly competitive markets precludes neither power nor domination, and that equal opportunity for political influence precludes domination under very restrictive conditions. I use a term in the paper which I call Walrasian domination. And Walrasian domination, that I will throw around the term a little bit, is domination that coexists with perfectly competitive, exit-inclusive, and egalitarian political relations. And I borrow the term Walrasian from economics. Those of you who know some neoclassical economics will remember Walrasian is a term that specifies frictionless market relations. So Léon Walras was this famous French economist, as you all know, who invented modern price theory, and who thought that if markets were frictionless, in the sense that markets clear instantaneously, there are no external effects to market transactions, and there are no transaction costs, the price mechanism will always find the efficient allocation of resources. And so if it can be shown, that's the argumentative strategy here, if it can be shown that domination under capitalism is pervasive even under these idealized conditions, then it can be shown that, then it will follow actually as a matter of trivial implication, that domination is pervasive even under the non-restrictive, non-ideal conditions of actual capitalist market transactions, under the frictional conditions of actually existing capitalism. And note finally that my object of criticism here is not markets generically. I have nothing against markets generically. It's only markets under capitalism. So the three claims I want to criticize are the following. The first one is sufficiency of exit. If there are enough and sufficiently good exit options to a power relation, then that relation does not constitute domination. The second one is sufficiency of competition. If all buyers and sellers in a market relation are price takers in the economist sense, that you have no monopoly or monopsony power, you just take the price of the market as given, then either there is no power relation between them at all, or it does not constitute domination. That's the second claim I'll try to refute. And third, that if each citizen has an equal opportunity to influence political outcomes, then any power relation between her and any other citizen does not constitute domination. I will also try to refute that claim, and I will also try to refute these claims jointly. So, let's get on with it. Here's a presumptive and preliminary counterexample to the first claim, sufficiency of exit. There is an open-air prison in which the guards have unjustly imprisoned 1,000 prisoners. The guards control the gates, which they can shut at will. They leave the gates open most of the time. The prisoners can get out. They have the exit option of getting out. As philosophers sometimes say, the prisoners enjoy negative liberty in this scenario. They won't face except under very restrictive, very rare conditions, which are not, let's say, exercised, they will not face any actual constraints on exit. And yet, it's very implausible to think that they're free. They're not free, not because they're constrained in the choice of exit, where they choose to try to exit. They can exercise the option. It's just that the option is not up to them. So the thought here is something like this. Exit options, bare exit options, do not suffice to give us freedom. We might be able to get out through that door now, but it's not enough for our freedom that we can get out because there's no constraint. If there's someone behind the door holding a gun or a baseball bat and says, you know, do this in order to get out, we're still not free. So the bare existence of an exit option does not suffice to give us freedom. Now, these examples, these weird restrictive thought experiments we use in philosophy are here to clear our heads, and you can see immediately what the implications are. If the existence of a welfare state, for example, or even of a basic income, even a very generous, luxurious basic income, is not up to us, but up to them, in some sense of us and them that needs to be further elaborated and explained on the basis of the theory I will defend, then we're still not free. So an implication of this theory seems to be that you need not just exit options, but exit options that are up to us in some relevant sense of us. If, for example, the generosity of the welfare state, the generosity and extent of a basic income, is not up to the members of a democratic republic, but is up to the choices and discretion of, let's say, the capitalists, then that's not enough to guarantee our freedom. So you can see, for example, here some obvious parallels with, let's say, patriarchal domination, a parallel between capitalist and patriarchal domination. It might be that the legal availability of divorce provides an exit option to women. But if the availability, extent, and intensity of the exit option is still up to men, that doesn't exonerate the patriarchy, and it still leaves women unfree. There's an obvious parallel here between capitalist and patriarchal domination. We can return to it in the Q&A. So that's a presumptive counterexample to the sufficiency of exit idea. And I want to talk a little bit about the sufficiency of competition idea. Recall, this is the idea that if buyers and sellers are price takers, so there's perfect competition in the Walrasian sense, then either there is no power relation between the buyer and the seller of the commodity, or it does not constitute domination. And here, of course, I have in mind the buyer is capital, the seller is labor. I forgot to mention, and that's very important, by capitalism here, I have in mind the monetized ownership of scarce productive assets by a class of people. And by domination here, I just mean the unjust possession of power over others. So, as I did with claim one, what I want to do now is try to explain why, like exit options, competition also does not suffice to exonerate power relation. And for me, this is important because it is widely held. Many, many economists, and at least some philosophers, think if a buyer has no market power, monopoly or monopsony power, then she can't have power. Competition suffices to exonerate a relationship between buyer-seller, at least at the level of the power relation. And I think that's a non sequitur. And I've spent a lot of time in my work on exploitation trying to explain why this is the case. But it's a pervasive and widely held idea by many, many economists. That's why I think it's important to think about it and try to criticize it. And long story short, I think that thought confuses market with economic power. Market power is the power you have in the context of a market exchange, which might be monopoly or monopsony power. Economic power is the power you have by dint of ownership conferred relations with others. So let me try to explain this a little bit. Consider another simple case, the buckets case. Buckets controls the water well. She sells full water buckets to Thirsty at unaffordable rates. Thirsty can't afford the rates that Buckets sells and makes a profit out of this. I take it this transaction is exploitative, and it is exploitative partly because it involves domination. It involves exercise of unjust power by Buckets over Thirsty. I ask you to grant me that assumption. Now, if something like this is true, then we can extend it to perfectly competitive relations between consenting adults. So consider competitive buckets. This is the economist's favorite scenario. There's an indefinitely large number of buckets, firms in this case, who control all the water wells. There's also an indefinitely large number of thirsties who want to buy water. That's Walrasian in the sense that it guarantees both that buckets firms sell at perfectly competitive rates and that thirsties buy at perfectly competitive prices. No one is a price, everyone's a price taker, no one is a price maker. Competition forces each bucket firm to sell water at the perfectly competitive rate, and each bucket sells water buckets to the thirsties at an affordable rate in order to make a profit. My claim is that if you think the buckets case involves domination, then you must also think that the competitive buckets case involves domination. Competition, even perfect competition, even the abstract, ideal, Walrasian relation envisaged by neoclassical economics does not suffice to exonerate a power relation as being a relation of non-domination. This is again a presumptive counterexample to the generalization that competition gets us freedom. Now, before I end with the stuff on equal political influence, let me just say the argumentative strategy here is to first think about the individually sufficient conditions and then bring them together. So what I want to do now is talk a little bit about equal political influence and try to explain why even under equal political influence, we're still not guaranteed, even if we had resourced equal access to political participation would still be dominated by capital. So the thought here is something like perfect competition, exit options, equal political influence, the conjunction of the three still don't get us a way out, still don't guarantee that our social lives are up to us. And the equal political influence move has recently been revived in political philosophy. Jan mentioned John Rawls, who famously defends what he calls a fair equality of opportunity principle, which is about equal chance to realize one's talents without any bias or inequality arising from class, race, gender, and other forms of morally arbitrary inequality. But of course, a very sophisticated liberal like Rawls thinks this is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for equal freedom. Some more recent liberal writing has not been so discriminating. And I'm thinking here the otherwise excellent book by Niko Kolodny, which seems to argue that equal political influence in that sense, if we had an equal political leverage over the outcomes of politics, we would, by dint of that fact alone, be free and equal. We would, by dint of that fact alone, would enjoy equal freedom. And I think that thought, the thought that it's both necessary and sufficient, equal political influence is both necessary and sufficient for equal freedom, is mistaken. And so here's a presumptive counterexample to that thought. There are two countries. One is philanthrocapitalista, call it P, and socialista, call it S. They have identical institutional safeguards for the protection of the basic liberties. They have identical income and wealth distributions and identical levels of capabilities and welfare per capita. Moreover, each citizen enjoys equally probable decisiveness at the voting booth in both countries. This is crucial. Equiprobable decisiveness is the term that Kolodny uses to specify his theory of equal political influence. It's the thought that everyone has an equal probability of being decisive at the voting booth as to whether candidate A or candidate B gets elected. The only difference that the means of production are the only difference between P and S is that the means of production are privately owned in P, but not in S. The structure of this economy, therefore, allows the philanthrocapitalists to announce that if taxes are raised, they will disinvest in the economy. Through no great stretch of the imagination. Disinvestment means fewer jobs, unemployment, and eventually an outvoted government. As it happens, the philanthrocapitalists never make such a pronouncement. But everyone knows what's going on. So I think this case and cases like it do satisfy Kolodny's requirement of equiprobable decisiveness. You and I, in the philanthrocapitalist society, would enjoy an equal probability of electing one candidate as opposed to the other. And yet, it would still be up to someone else whether that candidate is elected or remains in power for enough to realize, for example, a tax hike, an investment in health and education, a much needed expansion of the public sector, a disinvestment from missiles into human self-realization, and so on. The citizens of P, of the philanthrocapitalist society, could pull that off. They would have an equal probability of being decisive. But that probability would still be determined by what the capitalists, the philanthrocapitalists in this case, are prepared to accept. So the example shows, I think, that, again, equiprobable decisiveness does not guarantee that the policy is up to us. So the argumentative strategy for the domination theory and for showing why capitalist domination might survive under democratic capitalism is the same in all three cases. It consists in thinking about what it would take for democratic decisions to be up to the citizens as opposed to a very small subset of them, namely those who control the means of production. And what I've tried to argue is that neither the existence of exit options, nor the existence of perfectly competitive markets, nor even the existence of equal political influence suffices to guarantee that we are not dominated in our collective decisions, collective democratic decisions, to do things if they contradict the will of the owners of the means of production. For that, we need something else, something stronger, something that's not satisfied by these conditions as I have set them out here. Thanks for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.